Aloha. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, and today for Catherine Cruz. If you had $100 million to improve Hawaii's environment, where would you start? It's not a theoretical question. Thanks to the new green fees coming into the state budget this year, it's a set of choices to be made. Recommendations are coming very soon. We'll talk with Jeff Michelina. He's chairing the Green Fee Advisory Council. As sea level rise presses on, it's having different impacts on different islands. On Maui, it means moving for the Paia Youth and Cultural Center. Colleen Oechi of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative will have their story. And we heard plenty from you about cesspools. Reaction to our Friday call-in show and some new reporting just ahead. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. The Hawaii legislature opens for business a week from Wednesday, and between now and the opening session, we'll be hearing a lot about plans and priorities. From federal funding cuts to climate change, a lot of those priorities focus on Hawaii's environment. Today on The Conversation, we'll take a closer look at a few of them. Top of the list, green fees. This is a new revenue source as of January 1st. It's funded by a 0.75% increase in the transient accommodations tax, and is expected to raise about $100 million a year. What's the most effective way to spend that money? That's a question that faced the state's Green Fee Advisory Council, a 10-member group making recommendations on where and how to spend this revenue. The council is chaired by Jeff Michelina, a longtime environmental activist and policy specialist who's also executive director of Climate Hawaii. He sat down with us late last week to talk about those recommendations, what the people of Hawaii can expect about how this money will be spent, and a bit about the people who've been looking at the options.
So the Green Fee Advisory Council, first of all, you know, you said 10 individuals, and I just have to say this is such a fantastic hui of voices, perspectives, talent. You know, I figure we have about 200 years plus of experience on
this. Diverse group, too.
It is, very diverse. So we've actually completed our work in terms of the evaluation, looking at 600 plus projects, and coming up with our initial sort of recommendation, our portfolio for year one. And that's currently before the governor. We should be making that public within a couple of weeks. But really, you know, evaluating it across a range of, you know, dimensions in a rubric. We were looking at results, readiness, relevance, relationships, and region for the projects. And then across three buckets. There was an environmental stewardship bucket, things we think of, habitat, coral reef, the like. Climate resilience and hazard mitigation. So how do we become stronger than storms and sea level rise and all the threats that we face? And then the third bucket is sort of a sustainable tourism, regenerative tourism. How do we improve the visitor experience and reduce the impact the visitors have on our natural resources?
And I notice in the membership of the council, you have representation of everyone from conservation professionals through tourism industry folks. Did you find some common threads popping up in a high number of the proposals or spread out in different ways in different areas?
Certainly. You know, we received, we think, over $2 billion in proposals. We had proposals from
dollars.
Yes.
Ready to spend. Yes.
Exactly. So it just shows how great the need is, how big the gap is currently for climate resilience. And then also, you know, a lot of just deferred maintenance on our natural capital in Hawaii. So there is a pent-up demand. And looking at threads, certainly climate risk, very high, particularly post Lahaina tragedy. So fire was, you know, quite high. And those ranked very high, too. So it was a real challenge making those trade-offs and seeing, you know, what projects were ready to go that would really have a durable, tangible impact. The real magic happened finding projects that sort of transcend these buckets. So if we're reducing, you know, flammable grasses and putting in native trees or plants, we're going to be reducing runoff to the reef, possibly providing a visitor experience, increasing, you know, habitat. So there's some cross-cutting proposals that were really attractive. But it was striking that balance. What can we really execute in year one that's going to be visible, high impact, and really meet the standards of the law?
You know, the work has to have been impacted by developments at the federal government level. I guess, how has that shifted the way that you look at these mitigation efforts, preventative efforts, and that combination?
It's true that it has been shaped, although I will say that, you know, we are really kind of the masters of this domain here in Hawaii. There was a loss of federal funding, of course, across so many sectors. But really looking at this from, you know, our vantage of what are the needs, where are the gaps today, what are the geographic gaps that have historically been underfunded, and then really what are those high risk areas where we need to dedicate some funding. So, you know, gaps have been created by loss of federal funds, but we were really looking on a forward basis of what's needed, you know, what's the highest impact projects that we can execute.
You know, the cruise ship industry challenged the green fees in court, and now this is still involved in terms of the legal case, but federal appeals court, there's a ruling the cruise ships are not going to have to pay into this fund while another court challenge is pending. What has that impact been on your work?
I mean, it's been unfortunate. It's unfortunate that the cruise ships chose to do that, particularly when we know the burden that all visitors have in Hawaii and the desire to, you know, protect what you're coming to experience and explore, protect what you love. So it's unfortunate that they're choosing or attempting to choose not to be a part of, you know, this positive effort when every dollar we see coming in is really preventative medicine for climate change, but also improving that visitor experience. Particularly frustrating seeing some proposals from areas that are highly impacted by cruise ship visitors, bathrooms that have been overrun every time cruise ships disgorge passengers. These are areas that are just ripe for, there's a clear nexus between, you know, the tourism industry and impacts on natural resources. So as far as our work goes, you know, we're plowing ahead. We think that the state's going to prevail and those dollars are going to come in. So our budget is still what we're projecting, and we're going to really stick with that until we hear from the courts.
Fair enough. We're talking with Jeff Michelina, Executive Director of Climate Hawaii, also the chair of the Green Fee Advisory Council. He's also worked on environmental issues in Hawaii for decades. When we come back, we'll get some perspective on how that work has changed over the years. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with works from around the globe spanning 5,000 years, offering fresh discoveries and new perspectives. HonoluluMuseum.org.
I mean, I think everybody wants to get back to some sense of normalcy. We've had many instances of family members of police officers being stopped that are American citizens.
By ICE.
Yeah, it's definitely, at best, it is definitely questionable. They're not stopping family members of folks who are Norwegian or Irish. That's not happening.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Back with Jeff Michelina, the Executive Director of Climate Hawaii and also the Chair of the Green Fee Advisory Council. Jeff, you've been working on climate change in Hawaii for a very long time, and the impacts, how to deal with the impacts. The discussion seems to have shifted over time. How has it?
You know, I think you're right. The conversation has shifted. Climate used to be sort of this environmental thing, you know, someone else's issue. It's now becoming more and more core to everything. I mean, we're unfortunately seeing it in things like insurance prices.
Right.
People are actually experiencing this burden. You know, I reflect and I think sometimes we failed to message properly some of these impacts. You know, we showed polar bears with melting ice caps, but we didn't talk about, no, your insurance is going to go up because of these disasters that we're, you know, experiencing with increased frequency. So there has been a shift. The other, you know, interesting thing is technologies have evolved so quickly over the past 20, 25 years, where now, you know, we used to talk about clean energy is great. You know, there's going to be trade-offs. What do you want? Reliability, low-cost energy? Right. Now there's no trade-offs. And Kauai provides this fantastic example where for the past year, they're paying lower rates than the rest of the state, higher reliability with the most renewable energy. And that's going to continue. So irrespective of what's happening at the national level, we're seeing this massive shift thanks to technology, thanks to those learning curves of these technologies, where now this is a business issue. This is a jobs issue. This is a opportunity to decrease prices for everyone if we get it right.
The economics of climate change and the impact, the direct impact, not just on consumers, but with businesses, that is now a cost at a level that was not, perhaps it was imagined, but it wasn't in place not that long ago. That also has had to have an effect on how those businesses react and plan.
Certainly. And, you know, when we think of climate, we do think of sort of the two sides of the equation, the decarbonization. I know that's a word that we don't, reducing our
it's okay. You're on Hawaii Public that's Radio. Right. You can say decarbonization.
Reducing our contribution to the problem. And then there's the climate resilience, and that is right. Increasingly front and center, you know, and it's flooding. It's flooding in Mapunapuna, or it's wildfire, or it's things that people are now experiencing and then showing up in secondary ways like the insurance challenge. So yes, very much. And that, I think, attracted a lot of folks to the hui we created called Climate Hawaii, where can we take a new approach to sort of addressing some of these challenges? And can we get enough business and community leaders in a room and really work through the sticky issues, as opposed to, I think, the traditional approach, which I was certainly part of, where, you know, we're going to push really hard and get this thing across the finish line at the legislature or in court, but doing it, you know, more Hawaii style. And where can we build a shared understanding together, understand the solution set, and work through those trade-offs? And that's what we're hoping to accomplish with Climate Hawaii.
You know, that tone of collaboration is something that I've seen you sort of go through various phases of that over time on this issue. Your buy-in, you could almost make the argument that it's now more clearly in the self-interest of some folks who were a little reluctant in the past. How does that change the outlook for the future and sort of what you're looking for going on from here?
I'm certainly encouraging. Now you have people participating in this clean energy transition that historically may not have been your ally. I think a fantastic example is Par Hawaii, you know, has invested heavily, $100 million in a sustainable aviation fuel, you know, facility where they want to be producing a solution for Hawaii. I mean, our greatest need in terms of our carbon emissions is jet fuel. They want to be part of that solution. So just a fantastic example of, you know, they're part of this now too. We have, you know, obviously large solar firms that have, you know, many employees that are engaged. The utility is obviously committed to this transition. So yeah, definitely that kind of focal has shifted a bit to we are part of this. This isn't some exogenous outside, right, you know, little pet issue.
You know, that's people sometimes, when you talk about climate change and whether that's erosion, rising sea level, so many, there's this feeling of relentless negativity around it. And yet you bring hope to the work that you do. Talk about, for our listeners, about the hope that you see in your work.
You know, hope's a funny thing, right? And humor is hope's companion in arms, one of my favorite aphorisms there. And I mean, I don't think there's any other approach. I mean, we have to be hopeful and optimistic about this future we're heading into. What gives me hope, though, is the engagement I see from folks, things like the Nawahine climate lawsuit, where we had youth engaged, the first such lawsuit that settled, and now we're on a path for clean transportation. And then on that technology piece too, you know, this is no longer theoretical. I mean, we can see it, we can see the impact, we have social proof of it, like I said, on Kauai, and we have a great example here with the Green Bank that Gwen Yamamoto Lau runs, where we're decreasing the cost of living for everyday folks because of clean energy. You know, we're decreasing the cost first, and clean energy is this side effect. So I think examples like that really give me hope that we're moving the right way.
What's the biggest challenge for you?
You know, it is inertia. We have these systems, these structural systems in place that make it difficult to move. So I'm optimistic about the Nawahine lawsuit. I think we're starting to see the fruits of that as we move from sort of this agreement to, okay, what does it look like to actually get to zero emissions for transportation in less than 20 years? And it's going to be a Herculean task because it's going to require a shift in thinking. And, you know, people don't fear change so much as they fear the loss that might accompany that. And learning these new habits, it's a challenge. And, you know, thinking differently about getting around. Moving to an electric vehicle isn't that hard. But, you know, really rethinking our streets as multimodal is a little bit of a shift. There's going to be a mix of solutions, too, for, you know, jet travel. There's some drop-in solutions like sustainable aviation fuel. That comes with challenges, too. You know, how much farmland or ag land do we dedicate to this? Are there complementary crops? What does that mix look like? So there are going to be some challenging issues that we have to tackle. I think we can be smart about it and really think of, you know, multi-solving some of these problems. Green Bank, again, a great example. You know, we're reducing the cost of living for folks while we're providing clean energy. The agrivoltaic work that's happening in central Oahu, where they're actually profitably growing crops while they're providing solar energy, great example. So it's going to require a collaboration to think about moving beyond issue, you know, identifying the issue, but all right, what does the right set of solutions look like for Hawaii?
We've been talking with Jeff Michelina, Executive Director of Climate Hawaii and the Chair of Hawaii's Green Fee Advisory Council. Jeff, mahalo for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin February 2nd, olliuhm.org.
Minnesota was already in the headlines after a MAGA YouTuber released a highly misleading video alleging widespread fraud in Somali-run daycare centers.
This one's also generated nearly $3 million in the past.
And then Wednesday, an ICE agent shot an American citizen in her car. The battle for control of the narrative on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to helping women get healthy at their women's 10K and 5K fun run January 25th. Registration at hphwomens10k.org.
Sea level rise is another environmental challenge facing Hawaii, and it's showing up in different ways on different islands. On Maui, there's a particular challenge for the Paia Youth and Cultural Center. Colleen Oechi of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative has written about it in an article just out this week, and she joins us this morning to talk about it. Colleen, thanks for joining us. And, you know, this really is an example of sea level rise pushing a very specific change.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me. Yeah, like you were saying, this is this area of the North Shore is an example of what's happening in so many places on Maui. We have this youth center that's at the outskirts of Paia Town, and this area is known for the big surf, strong winds, really popular windsurfers and boogie boarders and surfers. But that the thing that's great for beachgoers is tough for the homes and the businesses that are along this coastline. And so we have this youth center that is seeing the coastline in front of it steadily erode. And so now it's having to look at relocating and demolishing the center that's there right now as the shoreline disappears and the sea level rises.
And this is sort of the next step in a situation that's been developing literally 4 years in different ways, but with a new level of severity.
Definitely. They've been talking about this for decades, and we've all known as a community that sea level rise, coastal erosion is a problem for us living in the islands, but it's starting to become more of a reality. You know, we have the Paia Youth Center talking about relocating more inland, and we have places like the Pali Highway from Central Maui to West Maui, which is the main artery for folks who are trying to get between these two areas. Now the state is talking about relocating that highway more inland. So these things we've been talking about, seeing and expecting for a long time, they're finally starting to push action on the part of, you know, governments and community groups as we have to adapt to what's happening with the environment.
And the youth center is moving inland, but they're still going to be in a flood zone, but they don't want to get too far away from the beach, basically. Is that right?
They are, and that's a struggle because that's part of the charm of the youth center, right? You come there, and it's right in front of the beach. The kids love, you know, grabbing their boards and running out to the ocean and catching some waves, and that's such a big part of, like, the culture and the community there. You know, every year they have, like, a surf competition. It's a big draw for the kids, and so they don't want to lose that access to the beach and the shoreline, and so that's why they're moving not very far, but they're moving more inland in an area that's like away from the erosion hazard line, but still in a flood zone. So they're going to have to make some adjustments as they build for things like, you know, at the second floor is going to be where all the activities happen. Nothing's going to happen on the first floor but parking. There's going to be features like breakaway walls that if there's a big flood, it would knock out those walls but minimize the damage to the main structure. So there's steps that they're taking within that flood zone. And, you know, I've talked to folks who are coastal planners who say, yeah, the ideal thing is to not be in the flood zone, but if they have to do it, you can take the steps to protect yourself against a potential event like that.
And meanwhile, this organization has been such a big part of the community for so long, and a lot of the people who work there came up through going to activities there themselves, and beyond the beach. One of my favorite things, of course, is they got a radio program going there too.
Yeah, the programs there are so cool. You walk into this youth center, and it's just so fun and full of life. You know, there's surfboards all along the walls. There's a big kitchen where the kids, like, learn how to cook. You walk upstairs, and there's a radio station, and Trish the Dish is telling kids how to, you know, do a playlist on air and learn to find their voice. And there's so many cool programs for the kids that you really don't want to lose this, you know. And so they're trying to figure out what does the future look like while we still hold on to these really important programs.
I love one of the lines that you use from Trish, which is, my thing's getting that phone out of their hand and getting them to talk about something that's not necessarily from AI. They come in here, they're naturally speaking from their heart, and they want to create something. That's great. The program itself, in terms of the plan, goes now to the Urban Design Review Board and eventually to Maui Planning Commission. Yeah?
Yep, so they're going to have to all take all the steps of, okay, here's our design, we're going to get approvals, they got to get permits, and then they hope to start construction next year, and it's expected to take about a year, so they're hoping for 2028. We know these things tend to take much longer than we expect, and so hopefully they can, you know, get this moving before the youth center is in real trouble. It's already starting to see concern with seawater sometimes coming up into the back of the youth center, so time is definitely of the essence, and they really got to move on this.
We'll keep an eye on that, and so will you. Thanks, Colleen Owechi.
Definitely.
Thanks, Colleen. Colleen Owechi is editor of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. You can find the story online at mauinow.com. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We heard from many of you during our live call-in show Friday to discuss cesspool conversions in the islands. For today's backyard quiz, pardon the phrase, the focus is on the fecal. We went down a rabbit hole to map the history of cesspools in the islands. Sewage problems have not been a new concern. There are historical reports of Honolulu vegetable gardens and taro patches facing contamination from cesspool overflow in the early 20th century. And some may remember Hanauma Bay closing for nearly a week to address an overflowing cesspool system at the popular tourist destination. There's a long history of cesspools in Europe, too, dating back to the 16th century. Cesspools were traditionally simple holes dug in the ground that were then lined with bricks or stones to allow waste to seep into surrounding soil. Every few years, a professional would clear out the solid waste that would accumulate in this pit. And now, for today's quiz, we want to know, what was the name of this profession in Tudor England? If you think you've got the answer, call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
Maybe you or someone in your household's been watching a little sports on television recently. The NFL wildcard playoffs continue today. The college football playoff championship is a week from today. College and pro basketball are in full swing, and then there's soccer. A lot of players and a lot of referees. Here in Hawaii, on the scholastic front, there's been a renewed focus on referees and parents behaving badly. Some refs are blowing a whistle of warning on this. It's a story that touches a lot of people, a lot of emotions. HPR's Cassie Ordonia has been following it and joins us this morning with some insights, yeah?
Yeah. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me. We saw last month that headlines and videos have surfaced of an incident that happened at Moanalua High School with two parents heckling referees that led to a school official being knocked out.
Yeah.
So we saw a lot of that. And the incident led to the State Department of Education permanently banning these parents from all public school properties. This is actually a first for them. And the attacks have illustrated a growing problem of violence against referees in high school sports. And some sports officials even worry that it's contributing to the decline of referees, which has postponed and even canceled games. But in my reporting, it's hard to say how often officials are attacked in Hawaii. High school sports associations, they don't keep track of that data, and state laws targeting attackers hardly have been used. So in 2020, there's a law that allows the courts to issue lifetime bans to spectators who harm sports officials. But then 3 years later, that state law was updated to elevate it to a second degree assault. But so far, only one person was charged under the new laws, according to the state judiciary. And it involved an incident last year with a man allegedly attacking a football coach in Kalihi during a scrimmage between St. Louis and Farrington High Schools. So some sports officials have also told me that they're already having trouble with recruitment and retention because referees actually don't get paid that much.
Sure.
So actually, referees, they rank one of the lowest in the nation, actually. That was according to Raymond Kaleo Benz, who is a referee. They get paid around $70 per game. And then other referees, like the linesmen, they get paid $55, while other states, they pay over $100 per game. I've spoken to Matt Sumstein. He's a football officials coordinator at the Hawaii High Schools Athletics Association, and he's seen the number of referees dwindle in the past few years. And for the football front, they're short 40 sports officials for both flag and tackle football. But Sumstein said something interesting, that the problem has magnified over the last 30 years because of the existence of high-resolution video, where parents kind of feel that they can take the video and they can watch the mistakes that are made and have all of these critiques. But now he said that's driven fans to have a mob mentality.
I started officiating high school football here in Hawaii in 1990. I finished my high school career in 2005 before I went to college and then on to the pros. Within that time frame from 90 to 2005, I've had people ride on the hood of my car as I left the stadium. We had a game at Kahuku one time. We were out there as officials and the lights went out. There was some form of power outage. So we're standing on the field in the dark, and the Kahuku coach, to his credit, circled the wagons, meaning in the form of his players around us in the middle of the field so that no fans could interact with us until the power came on. That's really a good sign of how the coaches and the players can interact with the officials in a positive way, but it amplifies and shows you that that was necessary because sometimes the crowd wants to get to the officials and they were there to protect us in that instance.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
But that level of intensity, and as you said, with high-resolution cameras, now everybody's an expert. And, taking what is a rough, volunteerish kind of job, nobody's doing this for the money in terms of the refs, and really just making it understandable in terms of the decline of folks wanting to do that.
Exactly. And that was just one example from a sports official. Now, I've actually spoken to some parents last week at a soccer game. Some parents, they weren't comfortable being interviewed, so they wanted to speak anonymously to what they've seen in the past games in high school sports specifically. And parents have told me that they've actually seen brawls break out between parents, and they're fighting in the stands while the game is going on. So that's kind of something when they've told me that. At first I didn't believe it just because that's something you would hear or watch in like maybe like a comedy. But it does happen. And those recent incidents with violence against referees and sports officials, they are prompting lawmakers to look into increasing harsher penalties for violence against education and sports officials. I've spoken to Representative Andrew Garrett, who also works as an umpire for high school baseball and softball, and he's had his fair share of heckling from parents. He told me that he's considering a bill that would enhance protections for education and sports officials, but the details are still unclear what that will look like.
You do have to have a thick skin when you work as a sports official, just recognizing that people get passionate. You know, sometimes parents think that their kids are going to be the next great thing in, you know, Division I athletics. They see this as a path to a potential scholarship or, you know, professional career. So sometimes they think that, you know, one official's call is going to prevent that from happening, which is never going to be the case, right? But this is just a trend we've seen, and we need to do more to protect our officials, or else, you know, if we don't do anything, then we're just going to have more and more who refuse to do this. And, you know, as I told people, like, you know, without any officials, there are no games. And ultimately, kids are the ones who lose out.
That's the thing. Ultimately, kids are the ones who lose out, but that's a decline in supply of folks willing to do this. Civility somewhere creeps in here on good days.
Exactly. And I've actually interviewed folks from the Oahu Interscholastic Association. It was the executive director, Bryce Kaneshiro, and he said there are protocols that sports officials follow in order to have a safe game. Mm-hmm. So normally when referees are being heckled and it goes past, you know, name calling, they'll talk to the coaches, they'll talk to the administrators, whether it be a principal or vice principal, and they'll talk to the fans to calm down. Sometimes it will work, but if it escalates, that's when the athletics associate director will step in and escort the parents off the property or the sports officials to get to the car safely. But the question is, why do parents behave poorly during sports games? I've actually interviewed Richard Weisford. He's a senior lecturer at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And he said part of the reason is we live in a high performance culture, and some parents live vicariously through their children, and some parents feel so merged with their kid that any affront to them in a game could feel like an affront to the parent.
It can become very survival of the fittest, like, you know, where parents feel like everyone else is looking out for their own interests. I've got to look out for my own interests and my kid's own interests. And that the sports cultures that really work are, you know, in part around getting people out of their individualism and thinking about the collective, what's good for the team. But also, there's nothing about sports per se that builds character. But with a good coach or good coaches, sports can be very powerful in developing character. It's really important for kids to understand what a tough job the referee has and to have compassion for the referee, not just get angry for the referee. It's really important for kids to not demonize kids on the other team, to recognize that competition can make you at least temporarily feel angry at people on the other team, but that's a function of competition, usually. I think more concretely, the kind of things that sports programs can do is have a compact or a contract with parents that spells out, you know, if I'm the coach, here's the contract. here's what you can expect from me. Here's my philosophy about playing time. Here's my philosophy about how I'm developing character in our players. And here's what I expect of you.
So sports officials, they are looking into evaluating their further protocols for safety.
Team sports, so crucial coaching, such a crucial part of that as well. Cassie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Cassie Redonio, she covers culture and the arts. As you know, you can read her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Join us for Live from the Atherton, our flagship event series celebrating music, culture, and community. This February, we honor mele as living tradition, as part of Mihina Olalo Hawaii. This year's performances feature Gregory Wan, Lady Laritza, Kiana Li'i o Mana'e Bertelman, and Aine. Live from the Atherton is sponsored by HMSA. For more information, go to hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Liliuokalani Trust's Lydia House, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Time for the answer to the backyard quiz. We told you about the history of cesspools in Europe and Hawaii. In the 1600s, the British created a unique profession to empty these cesspits. The job paid well, but was seen as so unseemly, they were forced to work only at night. Workers would shuttle waste from cesspools out of town on horse-drawn carts before spreading it on common land. This profession, thankfully, has been replaced by specialized tankers known as vacuum trucks that suck out the contents of cesspools. We asked you about the name for the 17th century English term of this for this undesirable job. It comes from the old English phrase gang, meaning to go. We were looking for gong farmers, and Daniel from Maui weighed right in with that. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If all the potty talk piqued your interest, you can listen back to our cesspool call-in show heading to our website or searching for The Conversation wherever you get your podcasts. Following our call-in show, we heard from several of you about your cesspool conundrums. Thomas had this to say. I live in Makaha and have a cesspool. I'd love to upgrade it to a more environmentally friendly system. No one seems to be able to provide me with information. I've been to the BIA shows in Honolulu, the Building Industry Association. I've asked individual plumbers, and no one has any idea how this could be done. I have many friends on the East Coast who have these systems, but I'm not sure that these are even available here. Since the state has not planned to include us in the sewer system, the state must be obligated to provide financial assistance to accomplish those conversions. Homeless encampments also contribute to water quality issues. Our water quality must also be improved by permanently moving people off the beach. And a listener left us this voicemail.
This is Butch Llewellyn calling from Lihue in Kauai. Regarding the septic system construction, I have a few points of consideration. First, what mechanisms will be in place to provide quality assurance for any septic system construction, you know, such as inspections and sign-offs? And what mechanism for the protection of the consumer or the homeowner for contractor scams, say unscrupulous contractors providing less than quality work? How will they be qualified to perform this work? And then how will we determine the success of any installed septic systems, either by yearly inspections or maintenance schedules? Thank you very much.
We also heard from Heather, who writes, glad we're having this conversation. I think it would be helpful to have coordination around this huge effort to convert. Firstly, there should be some financial assistance from the government, and Bishop leaseholders should get assistance from Bishop. Could there be shared resources coordination? If a whole neighborhood's required to take this on, could workers and machinery focus on that locale? Lastly, there needs to be a consideration of where we are on the island and how many people and how many acres of land we're concerned about being a problem. One person on 4 acres of land is not a threat to the land and water safety. And Mei Ling writes, I live on the Big Island, and to do this type of conversion by 2050 would cost an enormous amount of financial resources, of which the majority of people on the east side do not have. Are there any government resources, grants, or subsidies out there that would assist us in the conversion without having to get a loan or mortgage on our property? We appreciate your feedback. Let us know what you think by calling 808-792-8217 and recording a voicemail. You can also email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, many of you wanted to know about ways to fund cesspool conversions. We recently spoke with two officials with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about federal funding opportunities, as well as the problem of large-capacity cesspools. These cesspools serve at least 20 people or multiple residential units, and the EPA has banned them since 2005. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Amy Miller and Liz Borowick. Miller is the Region 9 Director of the Enforcement and Compliance Assurance Division at the EPA. Borowick manages the State and Municipal Infrastructure Section at the division. Miller starts us off.
We have found large capacity cesspools on all of the islands. Since the ban, we have, through enforcement, we have closed 3,900 large capacity cesspools in Hawaii. We have taken over 100 enforcement actions and have secured $5.6 million in civil penalties from facilities. I can't go into our targeting, but we're very good at targeting, and we try to consider also risk to groundwater, drinking water sources, as well as coastal waters in how we select targets. We are very focused on large landowners. And as part of targeting them, we hope to secure from them to do audits. So just to give you an example of a large property owner, Kamehameha Schools, we found that they had some large capacity cesspools, and they completed an audit as part of the settlement. And as part of that audit, they found another 192 large capacity cesspools. So they're in the process of closing that, and that makes it much more efficient for us versus, you know, individually by individual property. So we're constantly looking for ways to get the word out so that people know that they should, you know, if they have a large capacity cesspool, they need to deal with it. And by tackling larger property owners, we're hoping to make a bigger impact than just one piece of property.
Do you find that enforcement actions and civil penalties is the right approach for addressing large capacity cesspools? I mean, really, just to think about the carrot versus stick approach, have there been cases where folks either can't pay those fees or that poses a burden and they don't end up converting?
I'm glad you asked that question. Enforcement is one tool in the toolbox. My colleagues in water and my division work together, and we think about the bigger picture. So I would like to just give you an example. In the county of Hawaii, we recently do an administrative order on consent for them to look globally at wastewater. And this includes cesspools. And part of that is for them to do some planning and to think about the problem island-wide. And so enforcement can be a tool to help with that planning. And it isn't a penalty situation. It's like, let's agree upon a schedule and put that in a binding document that we're all going to be held accountable for. You asked about businesses that may not be able to pay penalties. We always consider that. And our first and foremost goal is to bring people back into compliance. So that's our number one thing. And that's what we're going to focus on first.
And on the other side of this, Liz, can you talk about some of the federal funding tools that might be available to communities in Hawaii that you feel like communities might not completely understand or might not be taking full advantage of right now?
Absolutely. We do provide many millions of dollars each year to Hawaii Department of Health for cesspool and other wastewater related issues. In fact, in last year, we were able to award $33 million to Department of Health for wastewater-related projects. And they've done an amazing job. In fact, just one thing to highlight is they took some of that money and they created a program especially for homeowners to help offset the cost of cesspool closures. And this was on in Kauai. And they plan to be able to help over 200 homes with these conversions. So this is just one example of the funding and the power of the funding that EPA is able to partner with our state to get this work done. We also have a huge program under the title of, you know, technical assistance. We are working with nonprofits on the island to help gather communities, do technical assistance in the form of like preliminary engineering reports, things like that, getting these communities ready to be able to apply for the federal funds. And I just wanted to say that, you know, EPA isn't the only funding source in this area. We also have USDA and HUD too, that also have similar funding for cesspools.
From where EPA sits, is Hawaii on track to meet the 2050 goal the state has set for converting all its cesspools?
I think that that's probably a question for DOH. What I can say with respects to large capacity cesspools is we estimate that there's still roughly about 1,000 large capacity cesspools still left. And so that's a tremendous amount of just large capacity cesspools that need to be taken care of. And we are going to continue to work on getting those closed. And, you know, obviously the ban for those was in 2005, you know, and I know that Department of Health is working diligently on this problem. And also I know that the governor is really pursuing some more funding to help meet this goal. And I think part of it is, again, I want to go back to, we need to have large scale plans for each of the islands about how we are going to manage wastewater. So that's a really key important aspect.
I wonder from your vantage point too, Amy, more recently, I think people in Hawaii have been looking at other regions, have been looking at Florida, where the conversion to septic hasn't been a fail-safe solution. So I guess, what do you want people to know when it comes to converting these cesspools? What's your recommendation at this point?
I definitely think it's worthwhile to look at options. And when we are taking enforcement actions, we sure do look at what the options are. We look at sewer maps, see how far they are from a sewer or a small package plant. And so we are trying to think about other alternatives than just septic. But if there is no other alternative, septic is far better than a cesspool, which is just a hole in the ground.
So 1,000 large capacity cesspools left. At what point do your priorities shift from converting those over to, you know, prioritizing other types of cesspool conversions? And do you have an expected timeline?
We're going to continue to focus on cesspools. We think of it as a larger picture about wastewater. So if, for instance, we see that the sewer systems are falling apart and need more focus and attention, we will shift our focus there. You know, cesspools is a significant issue in Hawaii, but we need attentive to the wastewater treatment plants as well for water quality purposes and for drinking water purposes. When I think about Hawaii and water, there are lots of things that we need to focus on, but cesspools continue to be one of the areas that, at least for the near term, the next 5 to 10 years, I could see us continuing to focus on it.
And Liz, thinking about the funding landscape, how things might have shifted over time, do you see like the funding streams being available for communities as being consistent in the next few years? Do you see any hurdles or roadblocks that communities might face in securing some of this funding?
Well, we've been really lucky over the last 4 years to be able to really supplement the funding to Hawaii for clean water projects. And we are hopeful that we'll be able to, again, this year, provide that supplemental funding. You know, you can't really say what the funding level will be in the distant future, but for right now, we have a solid base of funding. DOH is managing those funds expertly, and they are trying to leverage every dollar to get the maximum amount of environmental projects.
Amy, if progress stays uneven across the various counties and islands, at what point does EPA take a more active role? Is there a point at which, like, more of a takeover, like a shift away from the states managing this problem to something that EPA does with either, like, I don't know, a consent decree, with some other more active role of enforcement?
You know, the Department of Health has a very robust water and drinking water program, and we have a very strong relationship and a long history of collaboration, and we will continue to have that as our approach. And we will talk to them, you know, who's better suited to handle certain issues. There have been occasions where they've asked us to take the lead, or they have wanted to take the lead. And so this is part of our collaborative relationship, thinking about who's got the best tools, who's got the best resources. It's a really good relationship. And I am very confident in the state's program, in their compliance program.
What would make you change your opinion, if anything?
Change in opinion would be if they were failing to do their obligation under federal law of enforcing the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. If they fail to have resources to support this, then we have an oversight responsibility. And of course, if that was to happen, we would definitely first talk to them and talk about corrective measures and work with them to help bring their program back. But I do not anticipate that as a problem. The Department of Health, again, I want to stress, has a very strong environmental compliance program. We've been trying to think about creative ways to reach out to people that are working with property owners. We recently had a discussion with banks to tell them about the problem of cesspools and how they can play a role in financing and supporting businesses within Hawaii in making these conversions. And when they're looking at real estate transactions, to consider the cesspool situation of the property. We're constantly looking for opportunities to highlight the issue, and we will continue to work on finding large capacity cesspools and addressing this significant environmental problem in Hawaii.
Amy Miller and Liz Borowick of the EPA Region 9 office speaking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the agency's role in converting large capacity cesspools in Hawaii. That's the program for today. Tomorrow, we take a look at paid parental leave for teachers, what Hawaii can learn from Arkansas. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.